All right, Leviticus 26. Okay, these are blessings and curses. Blessings for obedience, curses for disobedience. Deuteronomy, it's not the end of the, I mean, there's several chapters after it, but I think 27 and 28, I believe, are blessings and curses as well of Deuteronomy, okay? So, interestingly, this was the usual way in the ancient Near East to end major legal text. Okay, so if there were a law, you know, a covenant or laws, a lot of times it ended with blessings and curses. Blessings for if you obey, curses for if you disobey. The interesting thing is, in a legal text of the ancient Near East, it was more appeals to their gods. You know, may the gods bless you if you obey, may they bring curses, rain curses down on you. Okay, but here, these are not just appealing to the gods, these are actually from God, and so they are sure. Okay, if you obey, these things will happen, guaranteed. If you disobey, these things will happen, guaranteed. Okay, so it's much stronger, it's much more than just an appeal to the gods to bless or curse the obeyers or disobeyers. Okay, so the promises will be fulfilled. Okay, so we're first going to look at the blessings. Can someone read for me Leviticus 26, verse 1 to 13?
You shall not make for yourselves idols, nor shall you set up for yourselves an image or a sacred pillar, nor shall you place a figured stone in your land to bow down to it, for I am the Lord your God. You shall keep my Sabbaths and reverence my sanctuary. I am the Lord. If you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments so as to carry them out, then I shall give you rains in their season, so that the land will yield its produce, and the trees of the field will bear their fruit. Indeed, your threshing will last for you until grape gathering, and grape gathering will last until sowing time. You will thus eat your food to the full and live securely in your land. I shall also grant peace in the land, so that you may lie down with no one making you tremble. I shall also eliminate harmful beasts from the land, and no sword will pass through your land. But you will chase your enemies, and they will fall before you by the sword. 5 of you will chase 100, and 100 of you will chase 10,000, and your enemies will fall before you by the sword. So I will turn toward you and make you fruitful and multiply you, and I will confirm my covenant with you. You will eat the old supply and clear out the old because of the new. Moreover, I will make my dwelling among you, and my soul will not reject you. I will also walk among you and be your God, and you shall be my people. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt so that you would not be their slaves, and I broke the bars of your yoke and made you walk erect.
Okay, so verse 1 and 2, we have a summary of the most important laws before the blessings and curses. Okay, verse 1 is a you shall not, so don't do this, and verse 2 is a you shall, what you should do. Okay, so verse 1, you shall not make for yourselves idols, nor shall you set up yourselves an image or a sacred pillar, nor shall you place a figured stone in your land and bow to it, for I am the Lord your God. Okay, no idols. And he describes idols four ways, right? An idol, an image, a sacred pillar, a figured stone. Okay, the idea is absolutely no idol worship. You know, no way you can imagine it, no way you can figure it, no excuses, no exceptions, no idol worship, right? Leviticus is about setting up the way to approach God, right? End of Exodus, God's glory comes down on the tabernacle, not even Moses can come in. How do we worship God? Leviticus. So therefore, no idols, okay? Because that is not the way God is worshiped. Verse 2, you shall keep my Sabbaths and reverence my sanctuary. I am the Lord. Okay, so two things, Sabbath and sanctuary. This is sums up proper worship, right? That you keep the Sabbath and that you reverence the sanctuary, that you view God's tabernacle as holy. Okay, blessings and curses start with proper worship of God. If you do not have a right relationship with God, all that's left for you is the curses. Okay, so if you're going to be blessed, no idols, keep Sabbath, reverence the sanctuary, is basically a summary of what should be done. Okay, then we get into the blessings. So verses 3 to 5, basically it's the gift of rain and good harvests. If you walk my statutes and keep my commandments so as to carry them out, then I shall give you rains in their season. Okay, remember last time we talked about how they needed the rains at the right time in the proper amount, right? They could get the rains in the right time, but not enough or too much, right? And it's going to greatly affect their harvest. So they need the rains at the right time and in the proper amount. Okay, so verse 4, I'll give you the rains in their seasons so that the land will yield its produce and the trees of the field will bear fruit. Indeed. Okay, so when God sends the perfect rain, the right time and the right amount, your threshing will last for you until grape growing and or grape gathering, and grape gathering will last until sowing time. So wheat was harvested earlier in the summer. Okay, and God says there's going to be so much harvest. It's going to be so big. You are going to be busy until the grape gathering, which is 2 months later. Okay, it's going to take you forever to process all your harvest because there's going to be so much. And there are going to be so many grapes and olives and figs, whatever happens during that time, that it's going to last you till sowing time, which is in the fall. So basically, if you obey, there's the land is going to produce so much because God's going to send the perfect amount of rain that you are going to be so busy that you're just going to constantly be harvesting. Okay?
That's cool. Thank you. Because I was, when I read this, I thought it was just like amount you could eat. And then I was thinking to myself, but what do they eat the rest of the year? You know,
yeah,
I wasn't computing.
Right.
That makes way more sense.
So, yeah, the idea is you have nonstop work to gather in the harvest.
Right.
Okay, so the idea behind that, right, is they would never have to worry about food. Okay, food would never be a problem. And if you know Israel, it's a very arid, dry land, and they have to get the rains in order to grow the food. And so God specifically put Israel in a spot in the world where they would be fully dependent on the rains. And who controls the rains? God does. Okay, so if you obey, God will send the perfect rains at the perfect time and the perfect amount. You're going to be so busy working the fields that it's just nonstop harvest from one harvest to the next.
Do you know if they had to worry about temperature? Like I'm just, you know, like here in Wisconsin, you know, it's not just rains. There's also like
right now.
Right.
So Israel is approximately, I think, like Southern California, I think. It will, well, maybe a little more north. It doesn't get super cold in the winters. It snows very, very rarely.
So
it's
a little bit more temperate.
Yes.
Temperature issues.
But the summer is hot. I mean, it's hot.
Okay,
so
that would be, rain would be more important to a hot summer.
Yes.
Heat,
yes.
Rather than just like temperature.
Right, than cold freezing. It's, yeah, yes. Yeah, they're more temperate. Okay, so if you remember in Matthew 6, right, 25 to 33, Jesus tells us not to worry about the grass, right? If he clothes these or provides for the birds of the air, how much more will he provide for you? So that idea is here. When you obey, you don't need to worry about what you're going to eat or what you're going to wear, right? Because the Gentiles worry after those things, but we are to seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, right? We are to obey. And all these things will be added to you as well. So the idea is there in the New Testament is what we obey, we serve God, and God will provide all these things. Yep, yep. Okay, so first, gifts of rain and good harvest. Verses 6 through 10, there's the gift of peace. Okay? I shall also grant peace in the land so that you may lie down with no one making you tremble. Okay? So they wouldn't have to worry about enemies. All right, and then if you look at verse 7, but you will chase your enemies, and they will fall before you by the sword. 5 of you will chase 100, and 100 of you will chase 10,000, and your enemies will fall before you by the sword. So they wouldn't have to worry about their enemies, and if the enemies did attack, they would be so easy to beat. 5 of them could chase off 100, and 100 could chase off 10,000, because God would be fighting their wars for them. Okay, if you look at the second half of verse 6, it says, I shall also eliminate harmful beasts from your land. And no sword will pass through your land. So God would even take care of the wild animals. So not only would you have peace from enemies, or they would just be super easy to beat, you're also not, don't have to worry about any wildlife. Okay, so you, the idea here too is that they will grow in number. Verse 9, so I will turn towards you and make you fruitful and multiply you, and I will confirm my covenant with you. If they obey, God's going to fulfill his covenant to Abraham that they will be a great nation, right? Multiply you as the stars of the earth and the sand of the shore. Verse 10, you will eat the old supply and clear out the old because of the new. Again, emphasis, you have so much food that when you bring in the new harvest, you haven't even worked through the past harvest, so you got to dump the old stuff to make room for the new stuff. Okay, abundance. Verse 11 through 13. This is the gift of God's presence, and this is the best blessing. Okay, it says, moreover, I will make my dwelling among you. That word for dwelling is tabernacle. So God says, I will tabernacle with you. God was to dwell in the tabernacle, okay? But if they disobey, just because they have the structure there, just because the tabernacle is there or the temple is there, does not guarantee God's presence, right? God is not confined to a building. So God says, if you obey, I will tabernacle with you. I will be in that tabernacle. My presence will be with you. Okay, so just because they had the temple or the tabernacle did not guarantee God's presence. Obedience did. Okay, and you have to remember, right? True obedience to God is just not outward conformity. It's not just outward conformity. You have to obey from the heart. Okay, verse 12. I will also walk among you and be your God, and you shall be my people. Okay? If they obey, God will do more than just dwell in the tabernacle where the high priest can only access once a year. Right? He will walk with them. This is about a return to Eden, right? Which is the whole goal, right? After Genesis 3, that's what we're trying to get back to Sabbath rest. We're trying to get back to Eden. So God's saying, if you obey Israel, it will be like Eden, where God walked with man. You will have an Edenic relationship with God. Okay, but you cannot have Eden without holiness. Right? Which is what we've learned. We had the clean, unclean laws, and then we had the holiness code. We had all the ways Israel was to be different, all the ways Israel was to be holy. Holiness has massive power in history because that's what brings us back to Eden. Right? And it's the same for us. We don't get to say, oh, I believe in Jesus and then live any way we want. Right? God calls us to be holy. Israel was called to be holy for God is holy. It's in the New Testament too. We are to be holy because God is holy. Okay, that's what sanctification is all about, becoming more Christ-like, becoming more holy. So that is the promise here to Israel, that if they obey, which we know they don't, but if they obey, they will go back to Eden. God will walk among men once again. And we know that he will. He will walk among Israel once again. It's just going to be in the future, not in the past. Verse 13, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt so you would not be their slaves, and I broke the bars of your yoke and made you walk erect. Right? And this is why Israel is to obey, because they are slaves of God. He saved them from Egypt, and they are to now obey him. Right? They are his slaves, and he is the one that set them free. Okay? So they are to be holy. Questions about the blessings? Okay, curses. This is a huge chunk, right? Curses were always longer than the blessings. And if you look at it, there's 13 verses of blessings, really, and then 14 to 39 are all about curses. So, all right. So why doesn't someone read for me 14 to 20? We'll do the first two curses, and then we'll do the other two curses. 14 to 20.
But if you will not listen to me and will not do all these commandments, if you spurn my statutes and if your soul abhors my rules so that you will not do all my commandments but break my covenant, then I will do this to you. I will visit you with panic, with wasting disease and fever that consumes the eyes and make the heart ache. And you shall sow your seed in vain, for your enemies shall eat it. I will set my face against you, and you shall be struck down before your enemies. Those who hate you shall rule over you, and you shall flee when none pursues you. And if in spite of this you will not listen to me, then I will discipline you again sevenfold for your sins. And I will break the pride of your power, and I will make your heavens like iron, and your earth like bronze, and your strength shall be spent in vain, for your land shall not yield its increase, and the trees of the land shall not yield their fruit.
Okay, so, I don't even remember. I think there are five curses. Yes, five curses. Okay, so these are the first two. So the first curse is in verse 14 through 17. Okay, and this is just general warnings. Okay, basically, for the curses, disobedience will result in the withdrawal of all of God's blessings. Okay, so everything that's good that's going to happen to you if you obey, basically you lose it all if you disobey. Okay? So here, right, verse 14 and 15 is basically saying, if you don't obey, right, and reject my statutes, abhor my ordinances, don't carry my commandments, break my covenant. Okay, so God's covered it all the different ways you can disobey. Okay, then what's God going to do? Verse 16, I will do this to you. I will point over you. Okay, so this is divine intervention to bring judgment for disobedience. I will appoint to you, right? God is doing this on purpose. Sudden terror, okay, so you're going to be afraid really for no reason. Consumption, so disease with fever that will waste away the eyes. Blindness, cause the soul to pine away. You'll sow your seeds uselessly because the enemies will eat it up, so the enemies are going to come and eat all your food. And you'll be struck down, right? God is going to set his face against you, so you're struck down. You will flee when no one is pursuing you, okay? Paranoia, okay? You're going to run away because you think you're in trouble even when no one's behind you, okay? So military defeat, paranoia. So bad things are going to happen to you. Oh, man. Disease. Okay. Yep. Consumption and fever. And that blindness caused the eyes to waste away. Enemies eat your food. They're going to come, military defeat, and then you're going to be paranoid. You're going to run when no one's there. Okay? Second curse, verse 18 to 20. If also after these things you do not obey me, okay, the goal, the purpose of the curses is to get Israel to repent and obey. And what we're going to see through the curses is if you don't do this one, then it's going to get worse. If you keep obeying, it's going to get worse. If you keep disobeying, it's going to get worse. If you don't repent, it's going to get worse. Okay, through five levels, basically. I mean, in the first level is bad, right? Fear, disease, lack of food, enemies, paranoia, bad. Okay, but if after these things, then I will punish you seven times more. Every time it's seven times more, sevenfold more. Okay, each level down gets seven times worse. Okay, and this is going to be drought and poor harvest. Verse 19, I will also break down your pride of power. Right, prosperity often leads to pride and self-confidence. So judgment cuts a man down to side and reminds him of whom he really depends, on whom he really depends. Okay, so Israel might be like, hey, we're doing good. Look at all the food we have no enemies. Okay, I get to now do anything I want, any way I want. And God says, oh, not so fast, right? Because just like I give it to you, I can take it away from you just as fast. Okay, and he says, I will break down your pride of power. I will make your sky like iron and your earth like bronze. Okay? Two really hard elements, iron and bronze. So this is severe drought. So when the rains are supposed to come, they don't. And what happens? The ground dries up. And all your labor will produce nothing. Okay? Verse 20, your strength will be spent uselessly, for your land will not yield its produce, and the trees of the land will not yield their fruit. So just like in the blessing, God can send the perfect amount of rain just as easily. He can send no rain, okay? And you will have nothing. Can someone read for me verses 21 to 39?
If then you act with hostility against me and are unwilling to obey me, I will increase the plague on you seven times according to your sins. And I will let loose among you the beasts of the field, which shall bereave you of your children, and destroy your cattle, and produce and reduce your number, so that your roads lie deserted. And if by these things you are not turned to me, but act with hostility against me, then I will act with hostility against you, and I, even I, will strike you seven times for your sins. I will also bring upon you a sword, which will execute vengeance for the covenant, and when you gather together into your cities, I will send pestilence among you, so that you shall be delivered into enemy hands. When I break your staff of ten, of bread, ten women will bake your bread in one oven, and they will bring back your bread in rationed amounts, so that you will eat and not be satisfied. Yet If in spite of this you do not obey me, but act with hostility against me, then I will act with wrathful hostility against you. And I, even I, will punish you 7 times for your sins. Furthermore, you shall eat the flesh of your sons, and the flesh of your daughters you shall eat. That I then will destroy your high places and cut down your incense altars and heap your remains on the remains of your idols, for my soul shall abhor you. I will lay waste your cities as well, and I will make your sanctuaries desolate, and I will not smell your soothing aromas. And I will make the land desolate so that your enemies who settle in it shall be appalled over it. However, I will scatter among the nations, and will draw out a sword after you. As your land becomes desolate and your cities become waste, then the land will enjoy its Sabbaths all the days of the desolation, while you are in your enemy's land. Then the land will rest and enjoy its Sabbaths. All the days of its desolation, it will observe the rest, which it did not observe on your Sabbaths while you were living on it. As for those of you who may be left, I will also bring weakness into their hearts in the land of their enemies. And the sound of the driven leaf will chase them. And even when no one is pursuing them, they will flee as though from the sword, and they will fall. They will therefore stumble each over each other as if running from the sword, although no one is pursuing, and you will have no strength to stand up before your enemies. But you will perish among the nations, and your enemies' land will consume you. So those of you who may be left will rot away because of their iniquity in the lands of your enemies, and also because of the iniquities of their forefathers, they will rot away with them.
Okay, so it gets...
Let me think. Would I rather...
Right? But we know. What did they do?
The bad.
Because that is the heart of man. And that is the point. Unless God changes your heart, even the threat of the worst punishment possible is not enough to bring you to repentance. God has to change our hearts. Okay, third curse, verse 21 and 22, wild animals. Okay. If you act with hostility, unwilling to obey me 7 times again, right? I'll plague you. Increase the plague on you 7 times according to your sins. I will let loose among you the beasts of the field, which will bereave you of your children and will destroy your cattle and reduce your number so that your roads lie deserted. Okay, so it's a reversal of verse 6, which says that God's going to eliminate the harmful animals, and verse 9 that says you will be fruitful and multiply. The wild animals are going to be so bad, they're going to eat your children and your animals, so that there's no one on the roads. No one wants to travel anymore because the wild animals are so bad. Okay? The reduction of population there. Verse 23 to 26, the fourth curse, war. Okay? So, verse 23, if by these things you are not turned to me, but act with hostility against me, then I will act with hostility against you, and I will strike you 7 times for your sins. I will bring upon you a sword, which will execute vengeance for the covenant, right? Because they don't obey the covenant. So war produces great horrors, okay? And so here we have the beginning of them. I will send pestilence among you, right? When you gather in the cities, right? So war comes, everybody runs to the cities for protection from the walls around the cities, and God's going to send disease in the midst of war so that you shall be delivered in the enemy's hands. Hunger. Verse 26, when I break your staff of bread, 10 women will bake your bread in one oven, okay? And they will bring back your bread rationed, so you will eat and not be satisfied, okay? God is equally as responsible for sending enemies to oppress Israel as he is for causing the productivity of the land to fail. So just like he can withhold the rain, send the rain or withhold the rain, he can spring the enemies or withhold the enemies, okay? Everyone is in God's control. And so this war, which causes horrific consequences, right, is from God himself. Okay, let's go to Judges 2. Can someone read for me verse 11 to 15?
sons of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals, and they forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt, and followed other gods from among the gods of the peoples who were around them, and bowed themselves down to them. Thus they provoked the Lord to anger. So they forsook the Lord and served Baal and the Ashtoreth.
Mm-hmm.
The anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and he gave them into the hands of the plunderers who plundered them, and he sold them into the hands of their enemies around them, so that they could no longer stand before their enemies. Wherever they went, the hand of the Lord was against them for evil, as the Lord had spoken and as the Lord had sworn to them. So they were severely distressed.
Okay, so Judges. It's not that far from Leviticus, okay? I mean, it's after the life of Joshua, but they had turned from God. They had served the idols, and what happens? God said enemies, plunderers. Okay? Fifth curse, verse 27 to 39. So this one's big. This is war and exile. Okay, so it just gets worse, right? First, verse 29, right? So again, God says, you act with hostility against me. I will do the same to you, punish you seven more times. Okay, verse 29, further, you will eat the flesh of your sons and the flesh of your daughters. Okay, can we go to 2 Kings? 2 Kings 6, verse 28 and 29.
What is the matter with you? And she answered, this woman said to me, give your son that we may eat him today, and we will eat my son tomorrow. So we boiled my son and ate him, and I said to her on the next day, give your son that we may eat him, but she had hidden her son.
Okay, so this woman, these two women come to the king because they ate one son and the other one hid her son so that he wouldn't be eaten. But we see that there's war, there's a siege, there's no food, they're eating their children. Okay, so this happened. All right, back to Leviticus, right? Verse 30, I will destroy your high places, cut down your incense altars, heap your remains on the remains of your idols, for my soul shall abhor you, okay? Then verse 31, I will lay waste your cities as well and make your sanctuaries desolate, and I will not smell your soothing aromas. I will make the land desolate so that your enemies who settle in it will be appalled over it. You, however, I will scatter among the nations. Okay? Verse 31, he's going to lay waste their cities. Let's go to Ezekiel 6. And can someone read for me verse 6?
Where you said 6, verse 6?
Yeah. Why don't you read verse 5 and 6?
Okay. And I will lay the dead bodies of the people of Israel before their idols, and I will scatter your bones around your altars. Wherever you dwell, the cities shall be waste, and the high places ruined, so that your altars will be waste and ruined. Your idols broken and destroyed, your incense altars cut down, and your works wiped out.
Okay, that's exactly what God said in Leviticus. Ezekiel is repeating it. Okay, their idols are all going to be brought down. Cut down, their cities are going to be laid waste. Okay, then there's exile. Can someone read for me Ezekiel 5, verse 10? Just one page back.
What was that again?
Ezekiel 5, verse 10.
Therefore, fathers will eat their sons among you, and the sons will eat their fathers, for I will execute judgments on you and scatter all your remnant to every wind.
Okay, so everything that God says here is going to happen in the future because Israel chooses to disobey. But these are not just side effects from war, right? Cannibalism, destruction of cities, slaughter, exile. They're not just side effects of war. They are the denial of all the hopes from the covenant with Abraham. So God promised Abraham a land, seed, blessing. They were to be a blessing to the nations, right? But now the curses are, if you disobey, God will do the exact opposite to you on purpose. Okay, so it is so much more than just war and the side effects of war. It is God doing it to them on purpose. Okay, correct, but he sent the wars bad enough to make them do that. Yes, because that's what he said was going to happen. Okay, but so it, instead of them being fruitful and multiplying, now they're eating their own children. I mean, you can't get more opposite than that. Okay, verse 34, we talked about this last week. Then the land will enjoy its Sabbaths all the days of the desolation while you are in your enemy's lands. Then the land will rest and enjoy its Sabbaths. Right, when we talked about, I don't know if it was last week, maybe a couple weeks ago, the Sabbath rest for the land, right, that they didn't do, and they certainly never did Jubilee. At least as far as we know, they didn't do Jubilee. Okay, and if they did, it was maybe once. I don't know. Yes.
That you mentioned the number of years in exile was related to the number of Sabbath
correct.
Years they skipped, but I thought it was the number of Jubilee years they
skipped. No, Sabbath years, 70. It's Second Chronicles 26, once every 50 years.
Right. Okay, so that'd gotcha. Be too long.
Gotcha.
36:21.
Yes. Second Chronicles 36:21, it says, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed its Sabbaths. All the days of its desolation it kept Sabbath until 70 years were complete. Okay, so the assumption in verse 34 is that if you are disobeying God, then certainly you're not going to keep the Sabbath years, because that would be one of the first things to go, which it was, right? I mean, you might obey God in other areas, but the command to not sow your land, that's a rough one to obey, right? You have to have great faith that God is going to provide for you. And so here the assumption is, if you're doing all these things, disobeying enough to deserve all these judgments, you're certainly not going to enjoy the Sabbaths, okay? But even here in Leviticus, right, they're not even in the land yet, okay? We still have 40 more years before they even get to the land, and then another 6 years before they've even conquered the land. And it's not even going to be this generation. It's going to be their kids that go into the land. Okay? But even here, God knows. And the curses are, you're not going to obey. The land's going to need its rest. I'm going to send you into exile. Okay? And sometimes it's hard for us when we read the Bible, because we know the whole story, right, to think, okay, where am I right now? Right? What do these people know? What are they hearing for the first time? You know, what shoes are they in? They're just hearing this as a curse. If we don't do this, you know, exile, all these things. They don't know the end of the story. They don't know that this is almost more like prophecy. This is how it's going to be. Okay.
When they talk about these cursings, though.
Yes.
Were there, and I assume there were, because there was always a remnant.
Yes.
There were some people who perhaps did obey.
Yes. Right. Like Daniel.
Right, but would you say it was just a small enough percentage that the nation as a whole
yes.
received the cursing?
Yes. I mean, because Daniel was faithful, right?
Right.
But he was still sent into exile.
Mm-hmm. So there was no way of knowing what percentage of people might actually
yes.
have been
yes.
faithfully obeying God
correct.
On their own.
Right, but I would argue that it was a very small remnant.
Most likely, because you think it was a larger percentage that they
right.
would have a more peer pressure influence
right.
on their
yes, right.
people.
And if you remember Elijah, right, what does he say to God? He gets really depressed, and what does he say to God?
He says, "The alone."
I am the only one. Now, granted, he was in the north. He was a prophet to Israel, right? And Judah and Israel, all their kings were bad. Judah at least had some good kings. Most of them were bad, but some of them were good. But Elijah thinks he is the only one. He isn't.
Right.
But I'm saying it's bad enough that he thinks, his perception is that he is the only one that is faithful to Yahweh. And God says, no, I think there are 400. Is that what he says? Something like that. But regardless, it's still a very small number compared to the population, everybody else. So he is not the only one, but it is bad enough that he thinks he's the only one. Okay, and I mean, the part of that might be his state of mind, right? But still, if a good chunk were obeying, he wouldn't get to that point where he said he was the only one. But yes, Israel as a whole rejects God. And so even if there is a remnant that obeys, now we don't know how God took care. I mean, we see what he did with Daniel, right? Daniel was sent into exile, but Daniel also rose to a place of power pretty fast, right? So we don't know how God protected the remnant that did believe, okay? But we do know, too, I mean, we have stories, right? God saves an entire city for Lot himself, one, right? And he has mercy on the rest. So, you know, we have stories like Lot and Daniel and whatever throughout the Bible. It seems like God protects those who are faithful. That doesn't mean, though, that persecution's not going to come and that, you know, you might die at the stake or whatever. Bad things still happen to believers, but God also provides the grace to withstand whatever trials he sends your way. So, yep. Good questions.
Question.
Yes.
What we're talking about is the original that came out of Egypt?
Yes. This is still the original. Leviticus happens at the end of Exodus, and there's like no time frame. Leviticus happens within like 2 months. Okay, Genesis is like hundreds of years, yeah. Right? Thousands of years, maybe.
Well, you said something about the next generation.
The next generation is going to be the ones that go into the land, actually go into the land, because this generation is going to try to go into the land and fail, right, which we're going to learn in Numbers, and then they have to wander for 40 years, and then it's not until their kids get to go in the land. Okay, but
they don't even know yet that they're not going to get to go.
No, they're still at Sinai. They are still at Sinai. They are still on their, you know, out of Egypt and at Sinai. That's where we are. In Numbers, we will finally leave Sinai. Okay. So Leviticus really, time-wise, takes not very much time. It doesn't cover much time. Okay. So the land needs to rest. And the thing is, even exile is not enough. Okay. Right. Verse 36, as for those of you who may be left, I will bring weakness into their hearts in the lands of their enemies. And the sound of a driven leaf will chase them. Even when no one is pursuing, they will flee. So you'll be so scared to death that you're just going to run at everything. They will therefore stumble over each other as if running from the sword, although no one is pursuing. You will have no strength. Verse 38, you will perish among the nations and your enemies' lands will consume you. So those of you who may be left will rot away because of their iniquity in the lands of their enemies. Okay, so not even exile is enough. In the land of your exile, you will be weak and afraid and die in terror.
Are they, when you were talking about making their life fruitful and
mm-hmm. multiply? Mm-hmm.
Are they, when they're at Mount Sinai, are they like sowing their food there?
No, no.
God's providing their food.
God's still providing manna. Okay. He provides manna for 40 years. That they're wandering in the wilderness. So a lot of these laws, the blessings of God will provide the right rain at the right time. This is all for when they are in the land. They're not in the land yet. But it's saying, I have given you my law. I have given you what you are supposed to do. When you get into the land, you are to obey my law. If you do, these are the great things that will happen to you. If you don't, these are the terrible things that happen to you. And the curses also, if you think about it, speak to God's patience, because they do not get to exile, right? They leave Egypt in 1446 BC or 1445. They do not exile until 722 BC and 586? 586. Okay, so that's 700 years of God's patience at the least, right? 800, 900 years at the most, right, with Judah. 800. So, and we know Israel for the majority of those years was not faithful. Only for brief snippets of time were they faithful. And that shows God's patience, that it took that long. Look at our nation. We're only 200 years old, right? So just put it in perspective of our nation, right? 700 years until they reach the end of this curse list, right? God is patient and gives them chance after chance after chance after chance after chance. Okay. All right. We gotta finish. Okay. Someone read for me verses 40 to 46, please.
But if they confess their iniquity and the iniquity of their fathers, of their treachery that they committed against me, and also in walking contrary to me, so that I walked contrary to them and brought them into the land of their enemies, if their uncircumcised heart is humbled and they make amends for their iniquity, then I will remember my covenant with Jacob, and I will remember my covenant with Isaac, and my covenant with Abraham, and I will remember the land. But the land shall be abandoned by them and enjoy its Sabbaths while it lies desolate without them. And they shall make amends for their iniquity because they spurned my rules and their soul abhorred my statutes. Yet for all that, when they are in the land of their enemies, I will not spurn them, neither will I abhor them, so as to destroy them utterly and break my covenant with them. For I am the Lord their God. But I will, for their sake, remember the covenant with their forefathers, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt in the sight of the nations, and I will, that I might be their God. I am the Lord. These are the statutes and rules and laws that the Lord made between himself and the people of Israel through Moses on Mount Sinai.
Okay, so as God always does, even after all the curses, right, there is hope of restoration. If, verse 40, they confess their iniquity and the iniquity of their forefathers in their unfaithfulness, which they committed against me, right? Then, verse 42, I will remember my covenant. Okay? There is always hope. God will never destroy Israel to the point of absolute obliteration. They are his chosen people. And so there is always the promise of restoration. Israel has to turn to God with her whole being, though, right? She says, if they confess their iniquity and the iniquity of their forefathers, and they have to admit that they act with hostility towards God and that he acted with hostility towards them justly. They have to admit the wrong they did and that they deserve the punishment God gave them. But Israel will God will never allow Israel to be totally destroyed. Okay, so let's go to Daniel 9. Can someone read for me verse 1 through 9? Daniel 9, verse 1 through 9. Well, let's see. That's a long... Let's start in verse 4, 4 through 9. So this is just Daniel praying. That's the I. 4 through 9. Daniel 9, 4 through 9.
God, who keeps his covenant and loving kindness for those who love him and keep his commandments. We have sinned, committed iniquity, acted wickedly, and rebelled, even turning aside from your commandments and ordinances. Moreover, we have not listened to your servants, the prophets, who spoke in your name to our kings, our princes, our fathers, and all the people of the land. Righteousness belongs to you, O Lord, but to us open shame, as it is this day, to the men of Judah, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and all Israel, those who are nearby and those who are far away and all the countries to which you have driven them because of their unfaithful deeds which they have committed against you. Open shame belongs to us, O Lord, to our kings, our princes, and our fathers, because we have sinned against you. To the Lord our God belong compassion and forgiveness, for we have rebelled against him.
Okay, and it keeps going, right? But this is Daniel's prayer, and he is doing exactly what God says in Leviticus 26 verse 40, if you repent, right? And Daniel, we know, was a righteous man, but he is taking on the sins of the nation. He is confessing the sins of the nation, all that Israel has done, right? And he says, we have not listened to your servants, the prophets, okay? It keeps going. His prayers all the way down to verse 19, okay? But that is the point Israel had to get to recognize that God's judgment was right and just. Verse 42, then in Leviticus 26, then I will remember my covenant. Okay. With Jacob, I remember also my covenant with Isaac, my covenant with Abraham. Okay. Here it does not detail what that remembrance entails, but in Deuteronomy 30, 1 through 5, it entails restoring them to their land. I'll read it really quick. We're running out of time, but Deuteronomy 30, 1 through 5 says, "So it shall be when all these things have come upon you, the blessings and the curse which I have set before you, and you call them to mind in all nations where the Lord has banished you." Right? Deuteronomy's like, there's not even a chance you're going to obey. "And you return to the Lord your God and obey him with all your heart and soul, according to all that I command you today, you and your sons. Then the Lord your God will restore you from captivity, have compassion on you, will gather you again from all the peoples where the Lord your God has scattered you. If your outcasts are at the ends of the earth, from there the Lord your God will gather you, and from there he will bring you back. The Lord your God will bring you into the land which your fathers possessed, and you shall possess it, and he will prosper you and multiply you more than your fathers." Okay, so God remembering the covenant, he will bring them back. He will restore them to the land. Okay. So these are the statutes and ordinances, the laws which the Lord established between himself and the sons of Israel through Moses at Mount Sinai. Okay? Leviticus could have ended here. Most people think it should have ended here. It makes more sense to us, at least, than chapter 27. But God is holy. He will not be mocked. He will be obeyed. Israel is his slaves. That's what he says, right, 45. "I'll remember for them the covenant with their ancestors, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt." They were slaves in Egypt. Now they are God's slaves. And when they disobey, they mock God because they're saying, he's not our master. We get to do whatever we want. We are not his slaves. He will not be mocked. If you do that, he will judge you, right? And Israel will come back. They will repent. And even today, there is hope. Israel will be restored. Okay, even though as a whole, Israel right now, many of them are atheists even. I mean, you have some that still believe in Yahweh God, but only of the Old Testament. But they too will wake up one day and they will be redeemed. And then they will rule the world like they were supposed to in the millennium. So there is hope. Questions? Leviticus 26. All right, Leviticus 27. This chapter is about vows and dedications. Okay? Vows are above and beyond a normal sacrifice. Okay, we've studied our sacrifices. A vow is something extra. Typically, it's a special offering of thanksgiving. Okay? One of the vows you might be more familiar with, 1 Samuel 1:28, is when Hannah vows Samuel to the Lord, right? She goes to Eli the priest. Well, he thinks she's drunk. And she says, "No, I just really want a baby." And Eli says, "By this time next year, you will have a baby." And she does. And she vows that if God gives her a baby, she will give him back to the Lord. And when he is weaned, she drops him off at the temple to be raised. Okay? You didn't have to make a vow. It was not required. Okay, but once you did, you were required to keep it. Deuteronomy, I'll read it really quick. I should have just stayed in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 23, verse 21 to 23 says, I can get there. Yeah, Deuteronomy 23:21-23 says, "When you make a vow to the Lord your God, you shall not delay to pay it, for it would be sin in you, and the Lord your God will surely require it of you. However, if you refrain from vowing, it would not be a sin in you, so you don't have to do it. You should be careful to perform what goes out from your lips, just as you have voluntarily vowed to the Lord your God what you have promised." Okay, so you didn't have to, but if you did, if you made a vow to the Lord, you had to keep it. Okay, this is an odd placement for this chapter, because it seems like Leviticus should have the law, right? And then you have your blessings and curses, the end. Okay, but instead we get this last chapter about vows and dedications. Possibly, so there are several theories about why it's here. Possibly it was just the next set of laws that God revealed at Sinai, and so Moses just put them where it was chronologically how it was revealed. Another idea is that possibly chapter 26 is God's vows to man. If you do this, then I will do this. Okay, and chapter 27 is how man is to deal with his vows to God. Okay, so can someone read for me chapter 27, verse 1 through 13?
Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, if anyone makes a special vow to the Lord involving the valuation of persons, then the valuation of a male from 20 years old up to 60 years old shall be 50 shekels of silver, according to the shekel of the sanctuary. If the person is a female, the valuation shall be 30 shekels. If the person is from 5 years old up to 20 years old, the valuation shall be for a male 20 shekels and for a female 10 shekels. If the person is from a month old up to 5 years old, the valuation shall be for a male 5 shekels of silver, and for a female the valuation shall be 3 shekels of silver. And if the person is 60 years old or over, then the valuation for a male shall be 15 shekels, and for a female 10 shekels. And if someone is too poor to pay the valuation, then he shall be made to stand with the priest, and the priest shall value him. The priest shall value him according to what the vower can afford. If the vow is an animal that may be offered as an offering to the Lord, all of it that he gives to the Lord is holy. He shall not exchange it or make a substitute for it, good for bad or bad for good. And if he does in fact substitute one animal for another, then both it and the substitute shall be holy. And if it is any unclean animal that may not be offered as an offering to the Lord, then he shall stand the animal before the priest. And the priest shall value it as either good or bad. As the priest values it, so it shall be. But if he wishes to redeem it, he shall add a fifth to the valuation.
Okay, so here's the idea. We're dealing with people and animals at the beginning. Okay, so verses 1 through 8, vows of persons. Okay, so this was if you were to dedicate yourself to the service of God. Okay, you know, I vow that I will serve God, whatever. Well, problem. In God's model, only the Levites could actually serve at the temple, okay? So not any Joe Schmo could just come in and vow their life and serve God, at least in tabernacle, okay? So instead, you could pay a price. If you said that or did that, made that vow, then you could pay a price and the money would go to the tabernacle. So the idea is that instead of you actually serving, you have now paid the money to, you know, that would be the equivalent of your service, okay? We are not exactly where these prices came from, okay? Several ideas, of course, always. Possibly it's the value of a slave that you would get if you sold yourself in the slave market, okay? And it may, okay, women are always less, right? But women also can do less work, okay? Less manual labor, at least, right? I mean, we can do plenty of work, but less manual labor, okay? So it's possible what you would get in the slave market. It's possible that it was the wage of a worker, but a one-month-old's not going to work at all. Or relative worth of the value of your service in the tabernacle. So a young man could, if they were allowed to serve in the tabernacle, do a lot more work than a 5-year-old. Okay. Also, because infants and like 5-year-olds are included, it was possible, you know, it seems that the father could vow not only his life, but those of his family as well. Okay. How often this happened, I don't know. I'm not sure. But that's how you were to do it. And again, if you are poor, right, then there was an exception for you and the priest would set a monetary amount that you could then pay. And the money would then go to the priests and the Levites to help them do whatever it is that they needed to do. Okay, help them survive. Okay, 9 to 13 is animals. Okay, it was very common to vow sacrificial animals, so like basically make an extra sacrifice to the Lord, okay, of thanksgiving, okay? When you made that vow, you would identify a specific animal, right? And we know that because verse 10 says he shall not replace it or exchange it, good for a bad or bad for a good. So that means there has to be a very specific animal that you vowed, okay? I will sacrifice this sheep or this bull or whatever it was to the Lord, okay? Verse 10 warns against trying to exchange it. I think this is hilarious. Okay, so maybe you say, I vow my very favorite lamb to the Lord, sheep to the Lord. It's my favorite one. He follows me around, but in a, you know, whatever of Thanksgiving, I decide to offer this one. Well, then a couple days later, you're like, I don't want to give my favorite lamb. So why don't I give this other lamb over here that's basically the same and exchange it? Right? Verse 10 says, he shall not replace it or exchange it. If he does, then both it and its substitute become holy. If you try, then you lose both. both of them, your favorite lamb and the other lamb, now belong to the tabernacle, to God. Okay, so you couldn't. So the idea is you got to be watch out what you say. Okay, you got to be careful. So if you are going to make a vow to the Lord, it's serious. You can't just flippantly vow and then later decide to change your mind. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, right. And that's what Peter says, basically. Like, the money is yours. You didn't have to give it. But the fact that you lied about it, that's the problem, right? You could have said, this is only a portion, and that would have been fine. Nobody would have gotten upset. But yeah. Okay. Pride, exactly. Okay. So you can't exchange it. Then unclean animals, verse 11, if you vow an unclean animal, you can do that too. So a camel or whatever, you could vow to the Lord. And then the priests could either use it for work that they need to do, or they could probably sell it and use the money for whatever it was they needed to do. Now, if you vowed your favorite camel and you decided that you didn't want to, or you wanted to get the camel back, you could pay 20% more, okay, and redeem your camel.
So the priests just have to keep all the unclean animals hang on to them for a little while.
Well, I don't know. And I'm sure there was a time frame,
yeah,
right? But see, it's things like that when you understand why the Jews ended up with laws this big,
right?
Because it's like God says you can redeem it. Well, how long? The next day? The next week? 2 years? You know, what is the rule? God doesn't say. Okay, so you can kind of understand why they end up with all these ridiculous laws and rules, because they're trying to obey God's rules, and so they just make more rules of their own, and in the end, they lose sight of what God intended in the first place. But
the picture in my mind was just all these lizards in the priest's tabernacle.
No, that would make the tabernacle unclean. Well, if they die. No. Yeah. Yeah. So anyways, okay, so you could redeem the unclean at 20% at who knows how long after you vowed it. And maybe, then the thing is, maybe you speak a vow to the Lord and says, I'm going to give this donkey, and then you got to actually get it to the priests, right? So maybe by the time you get it, you've changed your mind, and so you say, value my donkey, but I'm going to pay you. I don't know, because it doesn't say. Okay. All right. Can someone read, or questions, any more questions, people and animals? Can someone read for me 14 to 25?
Now if a man consecrates his house as holy to the Lord, then the priest shall value it as either good or bad. As the priest values it, so it shall stand. Yet if the one who consecrates it should wish to redeem his house, then he shall add 1/5 of your valuation price to it, so that it may be his. Again, if a man consecrates to the Lord part of the fields of his own property, then your valuation shall be proportionate to the seed needed for it, a homer of barley seed at 50 shekels of silver. If he consecrates his field as of the year of Jubilee, according to your valuation, it shall stand. If he consecrates his field after the Jubilee, however, then the priest shall calculate the price for him, proportionate to the years that are left until the year of Jubilee, and it shall be deducted from your valuation. If one who consecrates it should ever wish to redeem the field, then he shall add 1/5 of your valuation price to it, so that it may pass to him. Yet if he will not redeem the field, but has sold the field to another man, it may no longer be redeemed. And when it reverts to the in the Jubilee, the field shall be holy to the Lord, like a field set apart. It shall be for the priest as a property, as his property. Or if he consecrates to the Lord a field which he has bought, which is not a part of the field of his own property, then the priest shall calculate for him the amount of your valuation up to the year of Jubilee, and he shall on that day give your valuation as holy to the Lord. In the year of Jubilee, the field shall return to the one from whom he bought it, to whom the possession of the land belongs. Every valuation of yours, moreover, shall be after the shekel of the sanctuary.
the shekel shall be 20 gerahs.
Okay. So here, okay, so we have people, animals, and now we have houses and land. Okay? Houses is easier, land is harder because you have Jubilee, which they didn't even do anyway. Okay. Houses. So you could dedicate your house to the Lord. Verse 14, if a man consecrates his house as holy to the Lord, then the priest shall value it. Okay? So basically, you could donate your house to the priest, is what it is, declaring it holy. Okay? So in essence, you're giving it to the Lord. The priest would gain ownership and then could do with it as they wanted. Maybe they were just going to sell it. Maybe they needed it in that town to live in. I don't know. Okay? But this is most likely houses in walled cities, because if you remember, the rules were if it's in a walled city, you had a year to redeem it and then you lost it for forever, right? It didn't revert back to you at Jubilee. Okay, houses in the fields, those reverted back at Jubilee. That's why the land section is a lot longer, because you have Jubilee to deal with. Okay, houses in walled cities, you didn't. So you could redeem your house at 20% more. But if you don't redeem your house, then the house is just the priest and they get to do with it what they want. And possibly you just had that 1 year maybe to redeem it. I'm not sure if you wanted. And again, you pay 20% more if you want to redeem your house.
Wait, I'm lost.
Okay.
Why would you redeem your house?
If you want it back.
But why would you, because why you decide to give, why would you give it in the first
place?
If your circumstances change and for some reason...
Right, if you're thankful for something and you decide to give your house to the Lord, I don't know.
And then
possibly, or sometimes I want... Yeah, I don't know. Or if you're saying, I'm going to give a certain amount of money and it's equal... I don't know. I thought about that too. Why would you then redeem it? But maybe you get extra money and you decide that you wanted to buy your house back. I'm not sure. Because you're not... when you give, make a vow, you give it to the Lord. It's not like you're getting paid for it. Like if you sold your house, right, you get money for it. And then if you want to redeem it back, you can, because you need that money for something else. So you're just giving it. It's a gift.
So, yeah, it seems like odd. Why don't they just say, I want to give $100.
Right. And just give it.
The Lord, instead of, I'm giving you the value of my house.
Yeah. I don't know.
That's just a way to value it.
Maybe.
I feel like even now there's a lot of people who have given cars to churches. Like
they right, give they give things,
car, you know,
but they don't then try to redeem it.
Right. No, but I just, you know,
yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know why they would.
A car I can see, but like a house, that's like where they live.
Right.
So are they really giving their house?
But if you're wealthy
house?
And you have the ability to have more than one, you're giving up your home
to the Lord and his
you
service.
You want to give that as a gift to the Lord. Yeah. So.
But then I guess I don't know why you would redeem it. Unless you changed your mind, you know, and I think the question is, how much do people really redeem things they vowed to the Lord? And it almost seems like it's hey, if you do something foolishly, if you make a vow to the Lord foolishly, it's going to cost you to undo it, right? If you say in a fit of whatever, I'm going to give my house to the Lord. And then the next morning you wake up and you're like, oh no, now I have nowhere to go. To undo your mistake is going to cost you 20% more than the value of your house. So it's, you do not make hasty vows to the Lord. That's kind of what I see. I don't know how often somebody would promise their house to the Lord and then want to buy it back. Okay. Okay, then we get to land. This gets complicated. Which I just think is a little ironic, because it all has to do with Jubilee and land going back, which they never even did. So how this worked out practically, I don't know. Because they didn't do Jubilee, and the land didn't revert back to its original owners, so I don't know how they interpreted all these laws practically. Okay, but verse 16. If a man consecrates to the Lord part of the fields, his own property, then your valuation shall be proportionate to the seed needed for it, a homer of barley seed at 50 shekels of silver. Okay, so you could promise your own land. And the valuation is determined by the size of the field and the years to Jubilee. Okay, so verse 16 is unclear. It says the seed needed for it, a homer of barley seed. So the question is it... You need a homer of seed to sow the field, or it is a field that yields a homer of seed on average, okay, is then the 50 shekels, okay? doesn't, for our purposes, it doesn't really matter because we don't do it. Okay, but the idea was they had a set way to value the field. Okay, whether it was it took a homer of seed or it yielded a homer of seed, right? That would, taking a homer seed would be a bigger field than yielding a homer of seed, right? Would be a smaller field. So however it was, they valued it. Verse 17, if he consecrates his field as of the year of Jubilee, according to your valuation, it shall stand. If he consecrates his field after, right, then it's proportionate to the number of years. So it matters how far you are from Jubilee on how much the field costs. Okay? Verse 20, yet if he will not redeem the... Okay, verse 19, if you want to redeem it, you have to redeem it again at 1/5 your valuation. So 20% more, okay? But because it's land, it would probably be also, because now once you give it and then when you redeem it, you're now theoretically closer to the next Jubilee. So you would then have to subtract the harvest that they'd already got out of it, right? But then still, whatever it's worth now, still 20% more than that. Does that make sense? Okay, verse 20 is also confusing. Yet if he will not redeem the field, but has sold the field to another man, it may no longer be redeemed. And when it reverts in the Jubilee, the field shall be holy to the Lord. Okay, so a couple things with this. Some people think that if you donated your land to the Lord, you had to redeem it before the next Jubilee. Okay, because the land needs to stay in your family. So the idea of verse 20 is, if you don't redeem your field, you lose it. It does not come back to you at Jubilee. So you have to buy back your field before the next Jubilee for it to stay in your family. You have to redeem it if you give it to the Lord. Okay? Also, verse 20 says, but has sold it to another man. The question is, how in the world can you give your field to the Lord and then sell it? Okay? So possibly it was that you give your land to the Lord, but the priests have a job. They don't have time to work your field. And you could be in Galilee, right? Temple's down in Judah. Now, there were priests and Levites that lived all throughout, right? But maybe it's not close to their home. Are they going to travel every day to work your field that you gave to the Lord? Maybe not. Okay, so possibly if you gave your field to the Lord, you still had to work your field, and then you had to give either the crop or the money that the crop yielded to the Lord. Okay, so I don't like working a field that I don't get anything out of. So maybe I sell the field to my next door neighbor. I get a chunk of money. And then every year I just give a portion of it to the Lord as if I were working the field, but I'm not, because I don't want to work a field that I don't get anything out of. Okay. If you did that, you lost the field permanently. Okay. So that's the idea. Verse 22. If he consecrates the Lord a field which he has bought. So if you buy your neighbor's field, you can now give that to the Lord. And you don't have to consecrate, you don't have to redeem it. On Jubilee, it would revert back to the neighbor that you bought it from. Okay, so you could pay to buy a field, right, and then just give it to the Lord. Okay. And it would revert back in Jubilee, which they never did anyway. Okay. Verse 25, every valuation of yours, moreover, shall be after the shekel of the sanctuary. The shekel shall be 20 gerahs. Okay, so there was to be a standard shekel that all these valuations were valued at. All these vows were valued at. Okay, there was to be no changing of weights and measures. It was to all be the same.
Do we know how much a gerah is?
I don't know how much a gerah is.
A gerah was about 1/50 of an ounce, or 0.6 grams.
I think a shekel, yeah. I think a shekel was about a half an ounce.
2/5 of an ounce.
Yeah.
Or 11 grams.
Yeah. There you go. All right. Can someone read for me verse 26 to 34? We got 5 minutes.
But a firstborn of animals, which as a firstborn belongs to the Lord, no man may dedicate, whether ox or sheep, it is the Lord's. If it is an unclean animal, then he shall buy it back at the valuation and add a fifth to it. Or if it is not redeemed, it shall be sold at the valuation. But no devoted thing that a man devotes to the Lord of anything that he has, whether man or beast or of his inherited field, shall be sold or redeemed. Every devoted thing is most holy to the Lord. no one devoted, who is to be devoted for destruction from mankind, shall be ransomed. He shall surely be put to death. Every tithe of the land, whether of the seed or of the land or of the fruit of the trees, is the Lord's. It is holy to the Lord. If a man wishes to redeem some of his tithe, he shall add a fifth to it. And every tithe of herds and flocks, every tenth animal of all that passes under the herdsman's staff, shall be holy to the Lord. One shall not differentiate between good or bad, neither shall he make a substitute for it. And if he does substitute for it, then both it and the substitute shall be holy. It shall not be redeemed. These are the commandments that the Lord commanded Moses for the people of Israel on Mount Sinai.
Okay, so we have three issues. Firstborn, something that has been devoted or under the ban. We're going to talk about that in tithe. Okay, so firstborns. You could not vow a firstborn animal because the firstborn animals, according to Exodus 13, verse 2, already belong to God. And so if it was a sacrificial animal, you had to give the firstborns to sanctuary anyways. And if it was an unclean animal, you could redeem it. You could buy it back. Okay, but you can't vow it because it already belongs to God. Okay, and here again, you could redeem an unclean firstborn at 20% more than its value. So that's verse 26 and 27. Okay. 28 through 29. This is a little more murky. Okay. This is the idea is that something has been set apart or devoted to destruction. Other places in scripture call this something that is under the ban. Okay. This is best explained by example. So let's go to Joshua. Can someone read 7 verse 1?
But the people of Israel broke faith in regard to the devoted things. For Achan, the son of Carmi, son of Zebedee, son of Zerah, of the tribe of Judah, took some of the devoted things, and the anger of the Lord burned against the people of Israel.
Okay, so God had said, you're to kill the Canaanites. Don't take any of their stuff, right? It all belongs to the Lord. It is to be destroyed. Achan sees, a gold bar, a beautiful mantle, verse 21. When I saw among the spoil a beautiful mantle from Shinar and 200 shekels of silver and a bar of gold, right? He coveted them and he took them. So God said, don't take it. It's mine. Achan, and we'll go there. We'll go there. So Achan says, I want it. I'm taking it. It was under the ban. It was devoted to God. He was not to take it. He took it. He dies for it. Okay. Second example, 1 Samuel 15. Yeah, somebody read for me verse 3 and then verse 20 and 21. First Samuel 15, 3, and then verse 20 and 21.
And utterly destroy all that he has. Do not spare him, but put to death both man and woman, child, infant, ox, sheep, and camel. And then where?
And then verse 20 and 21.
But the people took some of the spoil.
Verse 20 and 21.
Then Saul said to Samuel, I did obey the voice of the Lord and went on the mission on which the Lord sent me and have brought back Agai the king and of Amalek, and have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people took some of the spoils, sheep and oxen, the choicest of the things devoted to destruction, to sacrifice to the Lord your God of Gilgal.
Okay. Yep. So God says, kill everything. Saul does not. He spares the king. He spares the best stuff. Samuel says, what are you doing, Saul? I hear oxen. I hear sheep. What's going on? They're all supposed to be dead. Saul says, oh, it was the people's fault. They just saved the best so that they could sacrifice it to God. Samuel says, verse 22, has the Lord as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Better to obey than sacrifice. Okay? So everything had been devoted to God. It was under the ban. They were not to have any of it. Okay? They were to destroy it all. And instead, Saul took it, and because of it, he loses his kingship. Okay, God says, I'm going to choose someone else. You're no longer going to be my king. Oh, we're not done. I'm almost done.
Okay.
Okay, so that is the idea versus behind verse 28 and 29 in Leviticus 27, okay? These are things devoted to destruction, and that's how a person can be devoted to destruction, okay? So Agag was devoted to destruction. He was to be destroyed, and Saul spares his life, okay? You are not to do that. They could not be redeemed. If God says they're going to die, you could not redeem them. They were to die. The Canaanites, Agag, whoever it was, okay? Last, verse 30 to 33 is the tithe. Okay, you are to tithe of your fruit trees, your vegetables, okay? If you wanted to redeem it, you had to give 1/5 more, okay? So you were to give the 10% of all your harvest. And this was to support the Levites, so they would have food and stuff to live on because they didn't have the time to work fields. Okay, also every 10th animal, verse 32, was to be given to the Lord. And you were to not exchange it. Didn't matter which the 10th one was. Every 10th one was God's. And it could not be bought back. It could not be redeemed. If you tried, then you sacrifice both. Okay, if you tried to switch one out, then both of them go to God. Okay. Verse 34, these are the commandments which the Lord commanded Moses for the sons of Israel at Mount Sinai. Okay, so all these commands come directly from the Lord. And that's they're at an end, at least for Leviticus. Okay. Again, Leviticus, God is holy, and the only way to approach him is his way. But he has made a way for man to approach him, and this is the first time in history man has a set way to be made right with God. Okay, up to this point, there has been no specific way to be made right with God. Questions? Leviticus.
Yes.
Yes.
Something. But now he's got to add 20% to it.
Yes. Yes. The tenth of it is God's, and you were to give it to God, period. Okay? And you were to trust then that God was going to provide for you. So if you want to buy back what's already God's, you're going to have to pay more, which would put you in a worse spot financially. So you wouldn't do it. I would assume you wouldn't do it. Unless you just had to have those apples. I don't know. Yeah. Anything else?